It's Wisconsin Today. Last month, we received a message from Eric in Middleton.
The insurance we have for our condominium property here in the Madison area has increased over 400% this year over last year, and we could only find one vendor. What is the reason for this massive increase, and why are companies dropping condo insurance? What options do we have to reduce our costs?
When we looked into this, we found out that Eric is not alone. According to an analysis from the Wall Street Journal, home insurance rates in Wisconsin have increased by about 25% since January 2020, and throughout the country, they're rising even faster.
What's driving those costs for home and condo insurance? Philip Mulder is Assistant Professor of Risk and Insurance at UW-Madison. Philip, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Now, we're seeing insurance costs for houses, condos going up all over the country. Wisconsin, I understand, isn't the worst. Still significant, though. What kind of things are we seeing when it comes to those costs here in the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, this is not an isolated phenomenon. It's happening nationally. And what you'll hear in a lot of the national headlines are about states like Florida, states like Louisiana, places like California where you hear about hurricanes and wildfires. But it's absolutely true that premiums have increased a lot in Wisconsin as well. Like, I've certainly seen this on my own homeowner's insurance bill in the last 2 years here in Madison.
We don't have hurricanes, happily. We don't so much have the wildfires in Wisconsin. We do have some disasters. What kind of things happen in the state that are at least a contributing factor to those costs in the state?
Absolutely. So, you know, in terms of the disaster risk itself, what most insurers operating in the state are going to be thinking about primarily is hail risk. So, you know, comes through, that can lead to roof-related claims. And then there's just all the things that can go wrong in a home that are covered, you know, burst water pipes, liability claims, things like that. One distinction, because it might be on a lot of people's minds, right, the recent flooding in Milwaukee was, of course, very significant. Flooding is, in fact, typically covered through separate policies. These are flood insurance policies. So your homeowner's insurance does not cover flood. If you want flood coverage, you're going to need to be shopping with the National Flood Insurance Program.
Now, people might be listening thinking, hang on, we've always had hail in Wisconsin and burst pipes and things like that. Why would the cost go up because of that? Are we at more risk because of things like climate change?
So there's a lot of different factors at play here, and this is something that my co-author and myself have been looking into in recent research. And, you know, when we kind of look at where premiums are going up and by how much, in terms of some of the climate signals that we're really getting on this issue, a lot of that does have to do with wildfire and hurricane risk. However, that's not to say that insurers aren't also thinking hard about how their losses are changing in Wisconsin and a lot of the uncertainty surrounding that. So what you've seen in our state is first, you know, you saw it happen over COVID, and while cost growth has slowed, it hasn't gone back down, is the increase in the cost of repairing and rebuilding homes. And that's going to be a major factor for insurers because just like it comes as a huge surprise to homeowners when you learn how much it costs to say, you know, fix something around the house or put in a fence, that's the same cost that's getting passed through when you have, say, a hail claim on your roof.
You've mentioned, just before we started talking, you mentioned some research out there breaking it down county by county level. We're going to share that online at WPR.org. What do we see when we take that more granular view?
Yeah, absolutely. So that data, we're very proud of it. We released it just a few weeks ago, and this is what's informing our research. And, you know, in some cases, we can even drill down to the zip code level, but we've made available for every county from 2014 to 2024, you can see average annual homeowners insurance premiums that we've measured from a data set of over 70 million associated payments for people with mortgages. But at the end of the day, everywhere has gone up dramatically in the last 10 years. It's also interesting to compare us to our neighbors over in Minnesota. For whatever reason, you go from a county just on the Wisconsin side to just on the Minnesota side, and they're paying much more. Your state can really matter here because insurance is regulated at the state level.
Right. That regulation issue, some states are saying, okay, well, we're going to cap insurance price increases, double-edged sword. Maybe you keep the prices down, but the insurance companies say, well, maybe we won't do business in your state if you're going to cap our rates. How do you weigh that argument?
It's a fundamental trade-off that policymakers are ultimately going to have to deliberate because you've seen in some of the most extreme cases of this in California, they are having a lot of problem with some of the biggest insurers were not writing coverage anymore. And that's required these states to sort of put in place their own backed insurers to cover these folks, but then that risk is still ultimately falling on the state, right? Even if we keep the premium low, we create an alternative form of insurance. At the end of the day, if a home has a loss, someone's going to have to pay for it. In Wisconsin, we're lucky to not really have that as a fundamental problem. People tend to have their choice of insurers here and tend to be able to find coverage, but I think there's more to be done in terms of figuring out what is the right balance to strike.
Speaking of choices of coverage, we had an email from a listener that probably prompted this conversation saying, hey, our condo association's insurance prices went way up, and we could only find one vendor. There was no shopping around. Are you worried that more communities will be in that situation where they might have had three or four options, they're down to one or two?
Yeah, it is hard because for an insurance market to work, it needs to be competitive. So this isn't to minimize at all, you know, the importance of having multiple players so that consumers can have choices so that you can find the best deal. Condos are a really tricky point in this market. And, you know, this is another one of those subtle distinctions is we're kind of looking at single family homes. There's this whole other market for condos. Another line of research we're looking into there, once again, you know, the focus is on Florida, where this has reached a total crisis point. And a lot of these condos can't find coverage at all. People can't get loans anymore because the buyers wouldn't be able to buy insurance or they can't get sufficient insurance. Once again, Wisconsin is not as bad as that, but we are seeing some of these effects play out because a condo is a huge liability to an insurer. And a lot of these buildings are aging. And for insurers, they have to think twice about whether or not they want to take on that risk.
Now, people who rent might be listening saying, glad I don't have to worry about this. Hang on. Somebody owns that building and somebody has to insure that building, right?
That's right. So, you know, this is ultimately a cost that's being paid at the sort of market level, right? And ultimately, what's happening in terms of landlords' decisions is they're trying to decide whether to rent the home or sell the home. And they're making a calculation about how profitable it is to rent, given the cost that they have to pay. And if those costs go up, they either need to raise rents to maintain that level of profitability, or they're going to sell the home, and then that won't be a rental on the market anymore.
Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Philip Mulder is an assistant professor of risk and insurance at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the drivers behind rising home insurance rates. Now for a look at what this looks like on the ground and what options are out there for people facing the issue, we're joined by Michael Keener. He's owner of Keener Insurance Solutions, an independent insurance agency in Germantown. He served on the board of directors for the Professional Insurance Agents of Wisconsin for 6 years. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as we just heard, the prices and the rate increases for insurance can vary from state to state, even county to county. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods in the Germantown area?
Yeah, I gotta say it's been a crazy couple of years from the insurance standpoint as an agent. The amount of remarketing that we've had to do. Let's go back a little bit. We'll go back about 3 to 5 years. And just reading an article I just pulled up on CBS News, homeowners insurance costs have shot up by 70% since 2021. So, I mean, this is just a trend that continues in the state of Wisconsin. And what's driving it? One of the number one key drivers behind that is really the increase in severe weather that we're having. We're having more hail, more severe storms. In the business, we categorize them as cat losses is what they call them. Any claim that pays out over $1 billion. And from the years of 1980 to 2021, we averaged one cat loss per year. We're up to 5 cat losses right now per year on average from 2020 to 2024. So that's really driven up the cost. Obviously, the severity of the claims is greater. And, you know, without continuing profitability or increase in premium coming in to the insurance companies, it's shrinking capacity. We've had several companies pull out of personal lines insurance over the last couple of years, just completely because their loss ratios are running so high that they needed to just get out of personal lines. They just didn't feel it, you know, they had the capability to be profitable. So we're seeing that. It's a really crazy time in the marketplace in insurance, home and condo insurance. Yeah, it's just really crazy what we're seeing right now.
So you are an independent insurer, so you can kind of compare and contrast different options, if I understand things right, for customers. Are you seeing people have that sense of sticker shock? Like, wow, this is a big increase. I don't know if I can afford homeownership even with this kind of insurance going up.
100%. Give you another example, myself. I bought a house over in the Sussex area. It was about 5 years ago, and my homeowner's rate was about $1,400 a year. I'm now up to, you know, 5 years later, I'm paying around $2,800 a year for my homeowner's insurance. And another thing on top of that is the deductibles. You know, the insurance companies are requiring much higher wind and hail deductibles. You know, certainly in Wisconsin, we have a lot of storms in the spring, a lot of wind, a lot of hail. So that's, you know, something that is really driving up that cost. So insurance companies are requiring higher deductibles. That's very common in the marketplace right now. We're seeing anywhere from a 1% of your total dwelling limit, up to $5,000. So insurance companies are getting out of the roof maintenance business. And it's just something that we're going to continue to see. Insurance companies are tightening up their underwriting as well. So, you know, they're being very cautious of what they're writing, and you just got to make sure that you're taking good care of your property and doing all the things to keep those costs down.
Now, if you want to own a home or have a mortgage, you pretty much need insurance. What's your advice for people who are, seeing these prices go up? Is there any kind of shopping around they can do?
You bring up a really, really good point. So, you know, there's a couple different ways that people buy insurance products, and one is an independent agent and another is typically through direct writers. And as an independent agent, I have contracts with roughly 20 plus personal lines, preferred insurance companies. So when somebody contacts us, we have the ability to go out into the marketplace. We use comparative rating tools that look at all the different insurance companies that we work with. And this is the best part about it, is that we do still have competition in home and condo insurance. In the health insurance marketplace, with everything that's going on there, there's just not competition right now like there should be, and that continues to drive up the cost of health insurance. So on the home and auto side, you know, we do have a lot of competition. We have a lot of great companies. There's hundreds out there, and I would recommend to people that they do take a look every few years and make sure that they are getting the best coverage and the best price.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. You have a great day.
Michael Keener is on the board of directors for the Professional Insurance Agents of Wisconsin. He's owner of Keener Insurance Solutions in Germantown. We talked to him about rising home and condo insurance costs in Wisconsin and how to deal with it. We also heard from Philip Mulder, assistant professor of risk and insurance at UW-Madison, talking about the drivers behind those increases.
Coming up, when the Oneida Nation saw alarming literacy scores for its youth, the Oneida Reads campaign was set in motion.
We're ramping up still. More opportunities for kids to get that high dosage tutoring, more professional development for teachers and support staff, better partnership with our school district partners.
Efforts underway to close the reading gap. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Childhood literacy is a major issue in Wisconsin. Most recent test scores show only about half of Wisconsin public school third graders could read at grade level.
And those numbers are even more stark for students from the Oneida Nation. In 2022, only 5% of Native third graders in Brown County were reading at level.
So the tribe decided to take action. The result is Oneida Reads, an initiative that aims to get all Oneida third graders up to reading level. It's a big goal with a lot of community backing.
Ann McCotter is project and change lead for Oneida Reads. Jennifer Webster serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation. And Mark Paulus is CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation, and I spoke with them last week. Jennifer, years ago, you saw information on poor reading scores, and it really caused you to pause. What jumped out to you that then ultimately led to the Oneida Reads program?
Well, this term, when I came on council, we were doing part of our transition. We stopped at the higher education office. And at that time, it was Jackie Smith who explained what their department does, what they do for the community. And then she also went into some data about our reading proficiency for our Native kids. And at that point, I realized, you know, we're a multi-million-dollar half government, half community, half corporation. There's got to be something more we can do for our community. To find out that 95% of our children were struggling, it hurt. And I thought, there's got to be something. And then I ran into Ann McCotter 2 weeks later, and she said, you know what? There is something we can do. you know, we're going to put together a program. And, you know, Jenny, we're looking for a community champion. Would you do that? And I was all in, just knowing that something needs to be done.
Something needs to be done. Mark, what makes that third grade reading proficiency such a significant benchmark?
Well, as we've reviewed, up until third grade, students are learning how to read. And then after third grade, students are reading to learn. So with education, of course, there's required reading no matter what your education track. So it's vitally important that our students are on track with their reading so that once they are reading to learn, that they are academically prepared for success.
And I want to go back to that 5% of Native students were not at the third grade reading level. Was this crisis deeper than pandemic-related reading setbacks?
It was, actually. That data was from the 21-22 school year, so it was post-pandemic. But the data that we've looked at also shows this has been going on. And it's not unique to Oneida kids. It is a problem in our local area in general, a problem in the state of Wisconsin and in the country. But we looked at the Native student data in that 21-22 school year, and the demographics for Oneida or Native kids was the lowest. And so that meant we had an even stronger call to action. So yes, the pandemic did impact third grade reading, but it was a problem before the pandemic.
And fast forward then to the Oneida Reads program. Can you give us a classroom example of how this program is helping to fill gaps in literacy?
Sure. It really does come down to lots of different actions. So there's lots of ways Oneida Reads is touching early literacy. One example I can provide is through the Oneida Youth Enrichment Services Program. And those are teachers that are embedded within our partner school districts. And we have four public school districts we work with that the Oneida Youth Enrichment Services Program works with. And one example would be in an elementary school where we have a full-time teacher through the YES program who's working in a school district and helping the Native kids in that school, kindergarten through third grade, on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, the whole school day, full-time teacher, doing reading interventions using something called structured literacy or the science of reading. And they do that because they got some training, professional development through Oneida Reads in partnership with CESA 7. Our facilitator, Sarkis Wentland, uses what's called Lexia Letters, and we had 8 staff members who went through and got that certification last year. So having that right skill set is really important when working with kids who are just learning to read.
And Mark, you know, these interventions during the school day, so important, but what does this program do for perhaps after-school literacy or the partnerships with family members?
So we do have a number of programs within the Oneida Nation that are youth serving. One of those departments is our recreation department. The recreation department provides services and programming that our students, or many of our students, attend after school. And one of those programs is tutoring and academic support. So through the various departments of the Oneida Nation, we're providing support wherever our students are visiting or participating in programming.
And how important is having that peer-to-peer tutoring available to students?
Yeah, we do tutoring in several ways, but the research has really shown that high intensive tutoring is what really makes a difference, high impact. So that just means the length of time and how frequent it is during the week, how often students are getting tutoring. And so we look for lots of ways to provide those opportunities. And it's during the school day in many ways. It's also before school, after school, and in the summer. We also have, through Oneida Reads, been advocating for a program called called the Wisconsin Reading Corps, and they've been able to bring that tutoring support, which is high dosage tutoring, to four schools that we work with specifically. And some of those schools are within the Green Bay Area Public School District, and one of the schools is in the Seymour Community School District. So tutoring happens in lots of different ways, but it's really important that we make sure kids get enough of that tutoring, and that it typically is a small group, maybe 1 to 2 kids, sometimes just one-on-one.
So that's the high dosage piece of it?
Correct. Yeah. It's about, you know, is it 20 to 30 minutes in a chunk, and 3 times a week is the best situation.
Jennifer, as Oneida Reads has been unfolding and ramping up with these programs, what has been the response like from community partners?
We are so blessed to have so many community partners, you know, from our teachers to our tutors and our recreation center, parents, you know, parents are our partners as well. You know, just we had our second annual summit last week, and we heard from one of the parents who had their child in one of the tutoring programs over the summer. And she said her daughter's reading everything, and her daughter is so happy. You know, we're going to town, she's reading the signs on the way to town, and just really have blossomed with her reading. And that's so good to hear. It's so good to hear that the parents are making time to read to their children, because that makes all the difference.
In terms of the science of reading, in late 2023, Governor Evers signed Act 20 to improve and to change literacy instruction across Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, how does this factor into Oneida Reads, or is this making an impact?
Definitely Act 20 is a big part of what Oneida Reads is doing. So Act 20 brought structured literacy, or the science of reading, into the public schools, truly as a mandate. And it really is making a difference. And we do believe that Oneida kids are going to be much more likely to learn to read by third grade if they're given that structured literacy instruction. So we partner with our school district partners to really advocate and encourage and help adopt everything that is part of Act 20. So really, it's helping us to make sure that as we partner with those school districts, we bring it up in terms of what Act 20 is about. It's about science of reading, structured literacy. It's about doing those assessments and understanding where kids are at, knowing that if they're in the bottom 25th percentile on the Ames Web assessment, that they then get a personal reading plan, helping parents to understand what that's about and how they can advocate at the school for their child. But in general, Act 20 has been a really good thing for Oneida Reads, and to ensure that more Oneida kids will become proficient readers by third grade.
We're talking about Oneida Reads, this tribal literacy initiative to help Oneida Nation students read at grade level by third grade. And we're joined there by Ann McCotter, project lead for Oneida Reads. Jennifer Webster is here, who serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation, and Mark Paulus, CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation. Mark, how are you assessing the effectiveness of this initiative, and where do you look for the data, and how will you track it?
So the primary source for data is the Forward exam, which was mentioned. So we're continuing to monitor data as it comes forward through the Forward exam on an annual basis. We're also working through relationships with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction and our local school districts to gather as much information and data as we possibly can. The more data that we have, the better it'll help us to choose programming and set our direction so that we are achieving positive results with our students.
And you recently wrapped up the summit on reading. What were some key takeaways from gathering together to discuss Oneida Reads?
Really just a lot of gratitude for all the work that is going on. I think many of our participants left really impressed by how much effort has gone into Oneida Reads in our first year and how much is really just taking off now. So a lot of appreciation for the support of the collective impact partners that are involved with Oneida Reads. A lot of appreciation for just the amount of work that's going on. So people that really appreciate and want to be part of the change. So I would say that was the biggest takeaway, is people appreciating the work and wanting to be part of it.
If other tribal communities, other public school districts want to start their own program, I wonder what are some of the broader applicable lessons from a project like Oneida Reads? And Jennifer, you first.
I think, you know, having come out of COVID, you know, so many communities are struggling with just the effects of COVID. And then, you know, students struggling as well. So I think, you know, working with our partners, kind of putting together this model of what we've done, you know, communities don't have to start from scratch. You know, certainly the schools are working and you know, bringing forth as much as they can as far as reading. But just being able to be a part of this, part of this movement, and with that Act 20, kind of bringing everything to the forefront again, and sharing that awareness of how important reading is to your children.
I think about this movement in terms of you being a mother, being a grandmother of Oneida Nation children, and wanting this literacy focus, not just for the children of today, but for future generations. Jennifer, do you think about that?
Yes. You know, when I was a young mom, when my children were young, you know, we're having supper in the car, on the way to soccer, on the way to bowling, you know, reading just wasn't in the mix. Reading was right before bedtime, that 5 minutes before bedtime. That's where we spent our reading. And, you know, I kind of relied on the school system to take care of those educational needs for my child, not realizing how important that, how much that I have to be a part of that education as well. And then now that I'm a grandma, I've got a little bit more time, you know, to spend that time reading with the grandchildren. But just knowing that we need to push more time with parents and their reading as well.
Yes. Mark, what would your thoughts be if other communities want to start their own initiative?
Well, I think it starts with the data and understanding the data from as many perspectives as they can gather data. Number two is building awareness, both internally within their various departments and with those that they may be collaborating with, and then also building awareness with the community. And then finally, family engagement. So much of this revolves around the parents and the ability of the parents not only to be involved in reading with their children, but also being aware of the supportive services that exist in the community. Because, of course, the children, they're reliant on their parents for transportation and awareness. So really getting the parents on board is critical as well.
And Anne, you recently celebrated 1 year of Oneida Reads. I wonder, are there any lessons learned, or what are you looking ahead to in year two as the school year moves forward?
For sure. I think one of the biggest things that I would serve up as a tip to other communities would be to connect with an organization that we connected with, the Campaign for Grade Level Reading. They're a national organization. There's 350 communities that are all working to drive third grade reading like we are. So that really was helpful for us. And we officially became a partner community with the Campaign for Grade Level Reading in June. So that has been helpful. They guide us. They're the backbone organization that we work with. And in terms of what's next for Oneida Reads, we're not slowing down. We have a lot going on and we're ramping up still. More opportunities for kids to get that high dosage tutoring, more professional development for teachers and support staff, better partnership with our school district partners, for instance, with Green Bay Area Public, school district. We have their Title VI team, which are the individuals working directly with Native students on reading. They're joining our Oneida Reads cohort at CISA 7 doing training in that Lexia letters. So they're going to get a year of professional development in structured literacy along with our Oneida teammates. And just more partnership, I think, is a big part of what's coming next. And then the other big part of our focus going forward is more family engagement work to be able to make sure that families are part of the solution, that they understand their role in helping their kids become proficient readers by third grade.
I want a little more here on how Green Bay teachers are responding to this project. What have you heard?
Well, the good news is we had about 20 individuals from the Green Bay Area Public School District who were at our summit, all the way up to the assistant superintendent, David Johns. So that shows support. Out of 175 attendees at the summit, about 20 of them were from the Green Bay Area Public School District. We also have an action team that meets with the Green Bay Area Public School District quarterly. And we talk about the work of Oneida Reads and how we can partner together better. We've got great partnership from their early literacy team, the director and assistant director, down to the school building level. Matt Melkor is the principal at King Elementary. He presented at the summit based on the work they're doing with Wisconsin Reading Corps. So we have a really unique partnership with Green Bay Area Public, and that's something we've worked towards, and it's taken years to develop. But I'm glad to say they're a huge support in terms of all the things of Oneida Reads.
Well, Anne, Jennifer, and Mark, thank you so much for sharing about this program. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate.
Thanks for having us.
That is Anne McCotter, Project and Change Lead for Oneida Reads, Jennifer Webster, who serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation, and Mark Paulus, CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation. We've been learning about Oneida Reads, a local literacy initiative that aims to bridge the reading gap for Oneida students. We found out about this project on my recent visit to Green Bay, where I met up with listeners like you at a coffee shop to hear some of the stories that are part of the fabric of the community, including Anne and her work with Oneida Reads.
We would love to hear your stories of local community impact and projects. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or look out for another Wisconsin Today event in your part of the state. Tell us, where should we go next? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a group in Racine gets together to draw pictures of the world around them and gain a new appreciation of their local community.
You really, really, really see the world in a different way by becoming an urban sketcher.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of art making is a solo activity, but for the global organization Urban Sketchers, it's all about what and who you're surrounded by.
Here in Wisconsin and around the world, urban sketching groups bring people together to draw and paint pictures of the world around them, regardless of their artistic skill levels.
Kathy Wilson is the former executive director of the Racine Arts Council and the founder and current leader of Racine's Urban Sketching Chapter, one of four chapters in Wisconsin. She's here to tell us about what she calls her great passion. Kathy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us the basics, please. What do urban sketchers do?
Well, the main thing urban sketchers do is we sketch on location. So our whole goal is to be somewhere, wherever that is in the world, find an interesting scene, people, coffee shop, boat, whatever, and we sketch right on location. So we bring all of our tools with us, we haul all our stuff out, and just start doing our work.
Where did you first encounter urban sketching?
Well, it's interesting because I've been a three-dimensional artist my whole life and never wanted to do anything two-dimensional. And so I was at the Holland Tulip Festival a couple of years ago, and I saw this woman sitting under a tree with her bicycle, and I went up to her and I said, "Are you plein air painting?" which is painting on location. Mm-hmm. She said, "No, I'm urban sketching." And I said, "What is urban sketching?" And so she showed me her book, her sketchbook. She showed me her tiny little watercolor palette. And she was completely self-contained, sketching these beautiful tulips. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Because this was really, really exciting to see. And that was the start of it for me.
And this is an international organization that you've helped to promote here in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit, please, about the goals of Urban Sketchers as an international movement.
Well, Urban Sketchers Global has 439 chapters in the world. So anywhere you go in the world, you can travel and you can send a Facebook post and you can either join the event that they're doing around the world, or you can maybe say, I'm coming to travel to Fort Lauderdale or Greece or wherever, and there'll be a sketcher there that will want to meet with you. When I decided to pique my interest in all of this sketching, I thought, I can go to Chicago to sketch because there's a beautiful sketch group there. I can go to Milwaukee. I can go to Madison. But I want to do it in my own hometown. And so I started Urban Sketchers Racine. So we've been an official chapter for over a year now.
What was the response when you started spreading the word in Racine about bringing this group together?
People were so excited because they want to sketch right where we live. We love to go to Chicago, but we don't want to have to go to Chicago to meet other sketchers. And sketchers love to be together. The joy for us is not only sketching something, so we're doing our artwork, but we really love adventure. We love to travel. We love to spend social time with each other. So sometimes we'll have lunch and we'll sketch together. Sometimes we'll meet at the lighthouse or the beach and we'll sketch together. But it's just a real joy to be together. That's really the main goal.
And I wanted to ask about that group element of it, because in my head, you know, drawing, painting, sketching, whatever is a solo activity. Even if you're in a class, well, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. Why is that communal part of it, that group part of it, so important to the experience?
You know, I don't really know. I just know that when you are together, you're sharing your passion, and there is absolutely no judgment in this particular art form. You can have somebody that's as experienced as a degree in art, or you can have somebody that's a brand new sketcher, and everybody is so glad you're there. They're so glad you're sharing. They're so glad you're learning. And then when you're done with your group effort, we put all of our sketchbooks down on a table or the ground, and we call it a throwdown. And so if there's 15 people, there's 15 sketchbooks on the ground. We're looking at all the work. Then we pick them up when we all hold them and we take a group shot so that you can see that we're together, and the smiles on people's faces is what's so fun to see.
I wanted to ask you about that, the quality, because I'm somebody, if I really put my mind to it and concentrate and do a drawing, I can come up with something pretty mediocre, right? And I would be a little shy, I think, about getting together with a group of people that almost certainly includes better artists than me. Encourage those people who don't think of themselves as artists, who don't think they're, you know, capable of doing something high quality, to still check this out.
Well, that's the interesting thing about it, because when I started, I was not a two-dimensional artist, and I've never wanted to draw in my whole life. Like you, Rob, I had no intention of drawing. I could do a stick figure, but I began to do it, and I began to be encouraged by the people that were there. I'm very serious when I say there is no judgment in urban sketching. Everybody there is so excited that you've come. It's exciting to have you there and meet you and talk with you, but it's also exciting that you're wanting to try. And I just talked to somebody this weekend in Minneapolis, and she is an artist, and she was deathly afraid to sketch. She brought all of her things with her. She was with a group of 30 people. She did not sketch. She did not put anything down. She was standing right in front of me when we were looking at all of the sketches, and she was so interested in learning it. And I said, don't be afraid. Just come. Just do it. Just put your thing down the first time. And if you come and you don't want to put it down in the throwdown, don't. I mean, that's the thing. There's zero judgment in urban sketching. There's just excitement and encouragement.
Can you talk a little bit about the people who show up at urban sketching events in Racine? Anybody could try drawing from any walk of life, I imagine. You get a pretty big variety of people showing up.
We do. We have people that are young. We have people that are retired. Lots of retired people sketch, because a lot of sketch events are during the week. Usually the big chapters will have one sketch event a month. And that usually will attract, in our area, we attract maybe 15 people. In the big cities, they'll attract 80 people or 35 people or... and it's all walks of life. I mean, I've got four sketching friends that are architects, and they are so encouraging to everybody, and we can all learn from them. Then I have friends that are sketchers that are, oh, geez, all walks of life. They don't have anything to do with art. It's just their passion. So they come and they share.
We are talking about urban sketching with Kathy Wilson, leader of Racine's Urban Sketching Group. I understand there are four official urban sketching groups in Wisconsin, and given the numbers you mentioned, that's pretty impressive. Are you in contact? Do you people in different Wisconsin communities kind of trade back and forth at your events?
Always. That's part of the fun. I was just in Minneapolis, and I was at Urban Sketchers Twin Cities, but I have visited Urban Sketchers Chippewa Valley, Urban Sketchers Madison. I heard just today that Green Bay is looking into getting an official chapter there. So it's a growing thing because there's so much fun in this and so much joy.
How do you choose what you're going to get together and draw? Because when I've looked at examples, sometimes it's, you know, a scenic vista maybe, but sometimes it's, you know, people's plates at a coffee shop or something like that. It doesn't have to be something fantastically visually appealing to have fun drawing it.
That's very true. Wintertime, there's a lot of coffee shop sketching going on. It's fun to sketch in a coffee shop because you can sketch people. You can sketch your donut or your croissant. You can sketch your shoe if your legs are crossed. You can sketch groups of people that are sitting at the coffee shop. That's the thing. Sketching is whatever you want to sketch and wherever you are. It's just fun to do it. You learn something every time you sketch. Sometimes you're sketching perspective, so you're sketching buildings. Sometimes you're sketching landscapes and you're sketching lake views or sunrise or sunsets. In Chicago, it's very fun. We go down and we sketch the Bean. Here in Racine, we've sketched the lighthouse. We've sketched the Jacobin Center. We've sketched the beach. We've sketched the Main Street Bridge. I mean, it's just all kinds of things. It doesn't make any difference. It's all fun to do.
Now, what I think about a lot when I read about urban sketching and I look at the work people are doing, you know, it's easy. We see something cool. Many of us have a phone in our pocket with a camera on it. We might take a quick picture, maybe share it with somebody else. But when you're sketching something, you're really focusing on it for a while. You're focusing your mind and your attention on it. Does that make you see the world differently?
Oh, my gosh. I see the world completely different since I've been a sketcher. And I'm a photographer. I'm an artist. And so I've always seen the world through a different lens. But when I started sketching, now I see, oh, geez, look how that chimney is attached to that roof. Look at that tree, really. I mean, look at the branches and where they start. Look at the shape of your foot. I mean, a sketch and a drawing I've learned as I've done this is just, it's just lines and it's just shapes. So if you're thinking about that, you really, really, really see the world in a different way by becoming an urban sketcher.
Okay. And does that translate over, you're just going for a walk maybe or a drive and you're not sketching, do you still kind of have that eye for the world?
Every time I'm out and about, I am looking at how can I sketch that now. I see everything different, no matter where I am, what time of the day. It's how I see the world now because I've become a sketcher. I see things completely different.
And do you carry around some kind of sketch pad or something and maybe have moments outside of those monthly events where you're like, yeah, I got a few minutes. I'm going to sketch whatever.
I sketch every day. I have my pack with me every day. It's in my car. The other day I was just driving down the street and I saw this Episcopal church that the steeple was just so gorgeous. And I just pulled over in the parking lane and I just took 20 minutes and I sketched it. My watercolor was with me. I put it down and in 20 minutes I had something done.
Now you've mentioned you're a 3D artist. I imagine that includes a sculpture of some sort. Does sketching change your eye for the 3D art you do?
Ooh, that's not a question I've ever even thought about. The funny thing is I haven't been doing any three-dimensional art since I've been become a sketcher. That's what I do.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that's that. So this is something that satisfies the artistic urge.
Totally, totally. It's so self-contained that everything is in my backpack. My Micron pens are there. My watercolor. I've got a little bottle of water there that I carry with me. My sketchbook is there. You know, if you're a three-dimensional artist, you have to carry lots of stuff if you make pottery. You have to have clay and water and a mess. I'm a jewelry maker, and so I would have to carry beads with me. And, you know, I can do that, but sketching is just a different ballgame.
Now, you've mentioned meeting up with people in the Chippewa Valley and Madison groups, Twin Cities groups, and others. If and when you travel, do you try to build in a meetup with that local urban sketcher group if you're able to do that?
Absolutely. I was in Minneapolis this weekend to see my brother, who lives there. He's an architectural blacksmith, and I went to the sketch event. It was at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, and so I sketched with 35 to 40 people there, and then I called another sketch friend who was an architect, and I went to his studio for the first time so I could see all of his sketches, and we talked, and yes, I mean, you just make amazing friends in this world.
You mentioned gear and how easy it is. Like, literally, I could have a notepad and a number two pencil if I wanted. What have you gravitated toward when it comes to what you want to sketch with?
Definitely watercolor. Mm-hmm. You can have a water palette box in your kit that is maybe 3 inches by 4 inches and have 12 colors in there. So you can get a water brush pen. So it's a paintbrush, but it's got a small tube of water attached to it.
Huh.
So you don't even have to carry water with you, although I do. You can always just use this brush. So you have your watercolor, your brush, and your sketchbook, and that's all you need.
You mentioned earlier Green Bay is maybe on the road to adding yet another urban sketch or group to Wisconsin. If somebody's listening in a community out there that doesn't have one yet and they're thinking, hey, this is super cool, what goes into getting something like this started?
The main thing is to contact, go to the Urban Sketchers website, which is urbansketchers.org, and it's a fabulous website. It will guide you right to the place that says start a chapter, and then there are people that are volunteers there that will help guide you. The person that guided me, her name is Mary Jo Ernst, and she is in Michigan, and she used to be with the Chicago Sketch Group. I connected with her, and she guided me through every single step to become an official chapter.
You mentioned that, you know, there's no judgment here as far as quality from one person to another. That said, have you taken some of your watercolor sketches and said, hey, I really like this one, and maybe that goes up, I don't know, on the wall or at least the refrigerator at home?
I definitely do that. I've made cards out of them. I'm selling them in some stores, some coffee shops. I send them as postcards to friends. Sometimes when you sketch, you want to give that person the sketch that you just did. And there's no greater joy. I was down in Key West, and I was at an outdoor restaurant, and there was an oyster shucker. And I showed him the sketch at the end, and he said, can I have this?
Oh.
And I said, unfortunately, it's in my sketchbook, but I came home, I made a postcard, and I mailed it to him.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and the amazing, getting back to the social element, I mean, you're meeting people who you become acquaintances with, maybe friends with once a month. How much has this expanded the circle of people in your artistic and personal circle?
I'm astounded by what has happened in the last 3 years for me. The friends that I have now are actually more like family. I see them a lot. We text a lot. We Facebook and share a lot. Because there's no judgment, there's a lot of conversation that also goes in it while you're sitting there for 2 hours sketching with somebody. So you're at a coffee shop. You're enjoying that part of it. It's amazing the closeness of the friends that I have found in the sketch world in such a short period of time.
That's fantastic. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I really enjoyed this.
Kathy Wilson is the leader of an urban sketching group in Racine, one of four urban sketcher groups around Wisconsin.
We've been inviting listeners to recommend books from Wisconsin authors, and here's one emailed by a listener named Frankie. The book is Meet Me Halfway by Jennifer Morales.
Frankie writes, this book is a wonderfully written collection of 9 interconnected short fiction stories that take place in Milwaukee. Morales is a Wisconsin writer who lived in Milwaukee for many years. The book features characters from a wide range of backgrounds. I love this variety of characters. It helps me consider situations in the book from multiple points of view.
Frankie, thank you so much for the recommendation. And now it's your turn. Do you have a favorite book to recommend from a Wisconsin author?
Tell us about it. We can share it on a future show. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today.
While you're there, you can explore our archives of great conversations and share your favorite Wisconsin Today interviews, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.